Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Forged in Fire, where we explore how LGBTQ+ leaders develop their leadership superpowers. You'll hear from guests as they share how they navigated their journey through adverse and crucible experiences to develop into amazing leaders. Forged in Fire is hosted by Lieutenant Colonel Bree Fram and Dr. Liz Cavallaro.
Hi, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Bree Fram. I'm an astronautical engineer in the United States Space Force and one of the senior transgender officers in the military. I'm a passionate advocate for the value inclusion brings to organizations.
And I'm Dr. Liz Cavallaro. I'm an adult development scholar and associate professor at the U.S. Naval War College. I'm also an experienced researcher, interviewer, leader development practitioner, and professional executive coach. Please join us as we discover the inspiring stories of how LGBTQ+ leaders are forged.
Welcome to another episode of Forged in Fire. Today, we're thrilled to be joined by Ron Oden. Ron served the residents of Palm Springs from 1995 to 2007, with 9 years on the city council, ending with 4 years as mayor, which made him the first African-American gay mayor of a U.S. city. Ron came out while serving as a city council member and has served as a professor, pastor, educational administrator, and politician. Last year, he was elected to the LGBTQ Plus Victory Institute's Hall of Fame for his long history of community activism and political service. Ron has a Bachelor of Arts in History, Sociology, and Theology from Oakwood College, a Master of Arts in Theology with studies in Family Life and Counseling from Andrews University, and a Master of Arts degree in Ethnic Studies from the State University of New York in Albany. He's also a proud parent and grandparent. Ron, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for allowing me to be here with you.
We are excited to have you, primarily because we love talking to leaders who have made history and have been through so many challenging things in their lives that create them as the leaders they are today. So for you, we kind of want to start in the middle, work our way backwards, and then talk about what's going on right now or in the recent past. What I want to know to kind of kick things off is about your coming out experience. Now, I understand you came out after a tear gas attack at the 1999 San Diego Pride, and you were already serving on the Palm Springs City Council. What was it that made you come out at that point?
It's interesting, the whole coming out process, because my life wasn't hidden. I had a partner at the time. I had just never made a public statement. And what I said at the council meeting is that I attended the San Diego Pride, not as an official council member, because I had been in the parade representing the city. But this year, particular year, I was not. And I just went as a member of the LGBTQ community. That was my coming out statement. I mean, it was in the news and in the papers and, you know, it's like, surprise, surprise. No, there was no surprise. And I said that because, well, kind of the way I introduced it was a little different. Because I said that I had gone, it reminded me of my first experience when I realized that someone wanted to hurt me over something that I had no control over. And I recounted an experience on my grandfather's farm in Alabama when I was maybe 5, 6 years old, somewhere in there. And we were at the dinner table. My grandfather lived on a farm in rural Clanton, Alabama. We did not have electricity at the time. So we were eating by kerosene lamp. And my grandfather sat at the head of the table. And all of a sudden, my grandfather got up and he had a real pensive look. And he never got up from the table until he was finished with his meal, but we had just started. And he went into his bedroom and he came back and he was standing in the door. He said, "Everybody, get under the table." And, you know, I'm hyperactive and I have ADHD. And so, you know, I'm thinking, what is this? We get under the table, my grandmother included. Is this some sort of game? Because my grandfather doesn't play these kinds of games, but we got under the table. And so I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And so I pull over very close to my brother because I figure something is going on, my older brother. And I asked him, I said, "What's going on?" And my cousin, who was a little younger than I am, but she lived in Alabama, and she leans over toward me and she says, "It's the Ku Klux, stupid." And I thought, oh my God, the Ku Klux. Like I knew what the Ku Klux was. The only thing that I knew that went cluck was a chicken. So in my young mind, I am imagining this humongous chicken that is outside. It has to be huge because my grandfather has his gun. I know how we kill chickens. We simply wring their necks. So for him to get his gun for a chicken just blew my mind. Now I'm horrified because, you know, we're just seeing the 50-foot woman. So I'm imagining the 50-foot chicken. And so my grandfather goes out. Before he leaves, I am still so hyper trying to figure out what this thing is outside that my grandfather needs his gun for. And he lifts up the tablecloth and he looks me straight in my eye and he says, "Don't say another word." Now, my grandfather never spoke that sternly to me. Well, probably didn't have to. And that worked for maybe all of 10 seconds as I heard the door close. And then I started asking my brother, what's going on? What's, you know, the Ku Klux? And about maybe 10 minutes later, my grandfather comes back. And that was the longest 10 minutes. I didn't know what was going on. And as soon as my grandmother heard the door, she climbed out from under the table and she ran and put her arms around me. She said, "Well," he said, "yeah, it was the Ku Klux." She said, and he says, "Well, what? How many?" He said, "Maybe 4 or 5 of them. They ran through the cornfield." And I asked my grandfather who they were and what they were about. And that's when he explained to me that these were a group of people who their mission was to terrify us. And possibly hurt us over something that we had no control over, the color of our skin. So that was my introduction to what racism and discrimination were all about. So when I went to the San Diego Pride and felt this experience and I saw people running in all directions, babies, animals running to the neighborhood, and the neighbors come out with water and their hose pipes to help people wash the tear gas and stuff off of their faces. It reminded me of that experience. And so as I recounted it, and I simply said, you know, that I went as a member of the community and not as a representative of the city. And that was the big coming out statement.
So Ron, having had many of those experiences early on, I'm sure you are aware of how significant it would be when you ultimately became elected as the first openly gay African American to lead an American city. And yet you had said at one point that it meant more to people than you ever would have imagined. Why was that the case? And what did you learn about what it really meant to people?
Well, even that statement of the so-called coming out, there were people who came up to me and expressed their appreciation and a freedom that it afforded them somehow to see the confidence that I had. And I think I have that confidence because I come from a place where people love me and they love me regardless. You know, my parents, my siblings, my children, my grandchildren, You know, I'm very fortunate in that respect. And I think that that's something that you continue to share. So the sharing of that experience and acceptance, I think, just makes a difference. And you could never tell how much of a difference that it makes. It simply is.
So let's go back kind of to that beginning and that moment where you had that encounter with the Klan, and then moving into a family that supported you for who you were. Is there a relation there in that seeing that bigotry, that hatred, kind of creates a counterreaction to love and to express that amongst the family and in who you are? Did that create an environment that allowed you to grow up as the person that you became?
Yes. And I would say yes, because when you have that kind, when you experience, look, I come from a long line of people who are Christians or call themselves Christians. And they try to live that. When I say that, I mean the tenets of Christianity, of love and acceptance, even when it was difficult. You know, and so I grew up with that. I think that that was also very prominent in my ministry when I pastored. And I think that that was, I didn't change who I am essentially. My ministry just went into a different area. But love and acceptance of people is part of who I am.
Ron, in your experience, not only as a pastor, but in the many other roles that you've served, how have you been able to incorporate that love and acceptance and care that you've provided to others in your service, but also navigate what I'm sure it sometimes is difficult when it comes to aspects of the church and those areas in which you may find folks who struggle to fully embrace those values of acceptance, especially as it relates to the LGBTQ community?
One of the things that really, I think, was a challenge for me, when you grow up with this paint job, you know, you have to figure out how to navigate if you're truly going to love and accept people when you know so much wrong has been done and is being done to you or to your people. That's not an easy thing to do. I think I learned a great deal of that from my grandmother. My grandmother was born as a result of a liaison of the plantation owner where her grandparents worked. And she grew up on that plantation and not knowing that the plantation owner was her father. And she played with her brothers and sisters that she didn't know were her brothers and sisters. And the one thing that that really stood out for her was, in playing with the kids, they all talked about going to school. And she had approached the age, school age, and she was so looking forward to going to school. But when she talked to her grandparents about it, and I say her grandparents, she was raised by her grandparents because her mother passed away from appendicitis maybe a couple of years after she was born. So she recounts the story of the first day that the carriage pulled up to take the children to school. And she had gotten up so early, and her grandmother didn't seem to be enthusiastic about, you know, combing her hair or anything like she did on normally. And so she heard the carriage pull up, and she ran out the cabin and ran to the carriage and got in And she heard the men talking outside, you know, and they were using some words that she wasn't quite familiar with, like the N-word, and she can't go to school. But she heard that part. She understood that. And so they came and told her that she couldn't go to school. And she recounts that it took three men to pull, you know, a five-year-old child out of the carriage. And this went on for a couple of days before it hit her that she wasn't going to be able to go. But her grandparents told her that if she went the day that they would move away from the plantation, that she'd be able to go to school. And she still looked forward to going. And they eventually moved away, but I guess she must have been 12 or 13 at least when they moved away. And she remembers going to school, her first day of school. And she said all the children had to wear white, and they wore white to school. And when she arrived, the teacher asked she passed out our books and asked all the children to stand and to read. But she didn't know how to read. And she saw all these little kids getting up and reading. And she said, so when it came to her, she said she put that book down and ran out of the school, and she never went back. However, my grandmother learned to read from the Bible. So she was definitely functionally literate. She could read almost anything in the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. And she learned how to write. But when her father, all of his children except her, preceded him in death, and he sent for her on his deathbed, and she refused to go. She refused to go because he had never acknowledged her in life. And so living with that dichotomy of seeing people just ignore your existence, and all because of color, it affected her. And of course, she made sure, she promised herself two things, that none of her daughters would ever work in a white person's home, and they did not, and that all of her children would get an education. So education is important to me because of my grandmother's story. And all of my aunts and uncles finished high school. And for people of that generation, that was an incredible feat, and especially for a black person. You know, as a matter of fact, one of my aunts who just passed away a few years ago at 90 had her master's degree in education. So navigating between, look, how do you hate people that you come from? You know, that's part of who you are. And you can't continue to live a life of dualism. You've got to accept all that made you the person that you are and embrace it, even the painful parts. And that's a painful part, but it's still a part.
So let's talk a little about the person that you are. And I think that story touched on the educator and the importance of education. And if someone were to go to your website, they see the first thing listed is that you're a professor, but it also says pastor, it says administrator, it says public servant. And there are probably five or six more other things that you would say about yourself, whether it's a family man or something else, before you might even get to sexuality as being on that list of identities. Is that how you think of it? Is there a rank order to identities? Where do things play in all the many facets of who you are and how that develops?
That's an interesting question. My paint job is number one. People see that before they see anything. They may never know my sexual orientation, okay? But they're going to know that I'm a black man. And that's the reality of everything that happens. And there very often You know, I would address different kinds of social situations. And people would say, well, that certainly couldn't be your experience, but it is. And I'll give you an example. One day I was doing some work around the house and decided to run to the pharmacy to grab a couple of things because it was just quick. Now, normally I'm out in a suit and tie, but I'm working around the house. So I just run there and I'm going down the aisle. Every aisle that I go down, I'm being followed. And it's so obvious and frustrating that I get to a point and I can project. And I turned to the person. I said, hey, you, come here. And I said, get your manager and get your manager here now. Now, mind you, I'm the mayor of this city. And they're following me around like a common thief. Why? Because I'm black and I don't happen to have on a suit at that moment. So the manager comes over and I pull out my wallet. And I said, look, you know, I just a few credit cards. I didn't even tell him I was the mayor at that point. I said, I can buy anything in this store that I choose to buy. I don't need to be followed like I am a thief. Then I may have said, yeah, and I happen to be the mayor of the city. And of course, he just starts swallowing air. We didn't mean that. I said, this should not happen. And I addressed it, not that it was an everyday experience for me, but for some others who happen to be the same color, it is. And they may not have a voice. So there are times I feel compelled to be the voice for the unheard. So yeah, that would be number one.
So Ron, it's interesting that you've had so many experiences, of course, throughout your life where that is the number one thing. It is not something that is hidden and it is always playing out as a factor in every interaction. And then in the realm of sexual orientation, that is something that many times people don't know. And for much of your life, people probably did not know. And yet it is something that has come to the fore. It is something, as you mentioned earlier, news stories and articles and magazines, right? Everyone comes out of the woodwork wanting to examine that. And that becomes another layer of identity that certainly puts you in a position to potentially be discriminated against or worse. But it also gives you opportunity to serve a community, to serve multiple communities that need your voice and need your support and need your educating and pastoring. How have those things come to play in your work in those many different roles that you've worked and served in?
Well, I was one of the founding members of CAPE. CAPE was the, California Association for Pride and Equality. It was the precursor to Equality California. I later became vice chair of Equality California. And I remember when the then president, it was Bush, made a statement that there will be no gay marriage. And we had a meeting that day in Palm Springs, and our representative, who later became our lobbyist, Jeff Coors, made a statement, and he used the word marriage, and the board was hot. They were going after his neck in that meeting, and I remember if we had been meeting, and I hosted the meeting. As a matter of fact, it was in Palm Springs. And I didn't, I wanted to say something, but I just waited until people got out all of their stuff. And I said, you know, this is a very interesting discussion as far as I'm concerned. Because when the president says that what we want is gay marriage, that's how everyone's going to see it. He's already set the parameters, and there is no higher voice on this subject in this country. As a matter of fact, at that time, in the world. So by our representative using that term, it wouldn't matter, no matter what he said, that's how it would have been interpreted. So I think that we make much ado about nothing. However, people were saying, it's not time, it's not time. I said, you know, growing up, I remember listening to my parents and different adults talk about Martin Luther King. And the discussion went one way sometimes and another way at others, where people saying, oh, he's pushing too fast, he's pushing too hard. There is never going to be a convenient time to get your rights. If that's what we're waiting for, it's not going to come. So if we don't take advantage of the opportunity and make the time, create the opportunity, it ain't going to come. You know, so the intersection of those things, of that experience at that particular time, made all the difference in our movement. Because it was that day that we decided to move forward. But it was also because of the experience. So having people, diverse people at the table when you're discussing. When I went on those boards, I was the only one. And even to this day, there are so many places that I go where I'm still the only one. And what they don't realize is that they're missing out on the big picture. And that's still very true of our movement. It is, unfortunately.
There are so many things I want to expand on in the stories that you've told. One, though, I want to pick up on a quote that I saw in an article you may have done about 20 years ago, talked to that experience that you just mentioned about being the only one. And it said, you know, it's one thing to be in a fishbowl, but when you move to an aquarium, it's a big difference. And often that only one, that leader who looks different, that leader who acts different, is watched intensely. And when you're the only one, it's even harder. What are those experiences that, you know, enabled you to survive that type of scrutiny that you would get, whether it was in a friendly environment like a board of an equality organization or in any other organization that you've been part of, or from hostile crowds that say you shouldn't be there? How do you build that resilience to be in that fishbowl?
I think it goes back to my foundation. I came from a very fundamentalist religious family. And I believed the things that I was taught. So I was competent to stand alone. People didn't have to agree with me. I knew what I thought. I knew what I believed. And I think, in addition, my parents would ask, well, what do you think about this? Gave me the opportunity to solidify my thoughts as a person and to make the beliefs my own. I didn't realize the value of that as a child, obviously, but it was indispensable for leadership.
That feeling of, look, I am my own person and I understand myself is such a developmental step that anyone can take, whether it's race, identity, sexuality. I own this. I am me. Yeah, that's a big leadership journey for anyone to take.
And that's also one of the gifts of coming out. You know, we talk about coming out and telling people, come out, come out. That's one of the most frightening experiences that a person can ever encounter. Because you're looking at your world and you know this one element can potentially turn it upside down. and you can lose everything and everyone. We don't talk enough about the benefits of coming out. The confidence it gives you, the freedom that it affords you, that, look, this is who I am. If you don't like it, that's fine, but this is me. But wondering all the time, who's going to say something? Or am I going to do something that will reveal what I don't want the world to know? It's prison. It's prison. And it's damaging not only to the psyche, but to the soul. I think that there's a spiritual connection to self-love, appreciation, and acceptance. In my mind, there's no question about it.
Ron, I know that you've shared that thinking, especially with young people, especially with young Black people, encouraging them not to be nervous to open up about their sexuality, to be able to live authentically. You've been quoted as saying, "You can be you better than anybody else on the planet, so no need in trying to be like somebody else."
That is definitely my quote. But to hear you tell it to me, you caught me off guard with that. Yes. Yes.
So, Ron, before you answer, when I heard you speak at the LGBTQ Victory Institute, I took notes and I was like, I can't even read my note, but I'm pretty sure he said, "Don't check the gag in the glass." And I'm like, no, that's not right. Oh, it's got to be, "Don't cheat the guy in the glass and the mirror." And I think that's so important and connected to this.
I think representation is important. So just being there. And actually, I think it becomes even more important as you get older. You know, because you can say things as a grandparent. And you're like, oh my goodness, that's your experience? So, you know, you really feel like that's your experience when you're young. When you get older, sometimes you think that there's a divorce from those kind of experiences that are of no value, but they're of greater value. Greater value. So I think you have example and encouragement. And I think in those moments when someone, especially a young person, is opening up, you have to water that flower. You know, give it something to grow, because it's expressing a need. And if it's expressing that need to you in that moment, you know what to give. And hopefully we are in tune with those moments.
Ron, I want to go back briefly to the story you shared about your experience in the store. And I think there's multiple things that we can take away from that. And we kind of touched on the fact that there are some similar experiences between people of color and LGBTQ folks, and there are some that are different. And one is obviously that you can identify a person visually who might be different, where an LGBTQ person, it might need to be revealed to you through an act or something, you know, a t-shirt or just getting to know the person about who they are. And that can shape our perceptions right away.
That's why it's so important to know who you are, because that's when you have the confidence to share with people who you are. And that confidence, sometimes it's really hurtful when people don't really share who they are and they expect other people to just know. There's just so many assumptions that you can't make in life today that we used to make about people, and especially based on appearance. So we've got to open our mouths and communicate and say, this is who I am.
Well, I think that touches perfectly on the second half, is that you did open your mouth and said, this isn't right. And that is something leaders do, you know, not just because you're doing harm to me, who can handle it, but you're doing harm to that next person that walks in and may not be able to. Again, this is an instance of how did that courage develop to take action? Because in any of those situations, we have to overcome that barrier of, I might get hurt for speaking out. I might get chastised for speaking out. What is it that pushes you to say, this is wrong, and we need to address it now to make it better for those in the future?
I have to go back to the foundation, because that's where I heard it. And I heard it long, deep, and continuously. And repetition deepens the impression. So it's just the way I see things. You know, if I see something, I'm going to say something. Now, there are on a few occasions when I have not, and it was difficult to live with myself. So it's not worth it to me not to stand up and say something if I see it. And yeah, it can cost you. You know, the woman in Lake Arrowhead, she stood up and it cost her. It should not have. It should. And one of the things that's about that particular situation that disturbs me is that so many people, because of miscommunication, think that she was gay and she was standing up for the flag. She's an ally. And I think that's what's even more important, that she was standing up and defending what a lot of us don't. Yeah, and that bothered me.
It was heartbreaking.
Ron, you've stood up so many times in your life, and you've had influence in so many different places in the world. And you spoke earlier, as it related to marriage equality at the time, you needed to make the time, you needed to create the opportunity. What's next on your agenda? Where else do you see that need for change and your role in making it?
Well, as I look at my role, I was appointed to the College Board of Trustees for our community college a couple months ago. I've worked in education from preschool through graduate school, public, private, and vocational as an instructor and as an administrator. So my heart's in education. And I am trying to create more opportunities for the young people who live, well, not just young, for the people who live in my district to better their lives.
Ron, one of the things that I can tell is obvious about you and probably factors into your strength as an educator is your ability to tell stories. And your stories, your family stories, have an immense sweep of history. I mean, you can talk to the stories you heard and can live and breathe and tell today about times from slavery to now and how things have either changed or have stayed the same. And there is so much depth there in understanding how things have changed for minorities of all varieties in this country. But as you look forward with that bastion of storytelling, where do you see us going in 30 years, are we still going to be talking about these same things? Or are we making progress where we'll stop telling some of these stories? I don't think we will, but where do you see us going?
This is a disturbing and frightening time. When educators are allowing a political figure to tell them what they can and cannot teach. And the country is just like, just kind of standing back and saying, well, that's there. No, that's not there. That's here. We are the United States. And that's frightening because you got half of the people, and you know, and I said this when I first heard it, because not only is it a dog whistle, but it's a threat. Make America great again. Well, it's better now for me and my people than it's ever been. There ain't nothing I want to look back to. Do you hear me? Nothing. So who is it going to be better for? And what would it was better for a certain group of people. Okay? So yeah, that's really frightening because I think we're at a pivotal point in our existence as a nation. Ultimately, I think we're going to go forward, but this may not be the nation that it started out to be. I mean, because there are people who don't want to let go of the past. And unfortunately, we made a horrendous mistake. We let social media go 20 years without any kind of fact check. So we've got an entire generation of people who can't tell the truth from a lie, even when it's right before them. There's nothing that's scarier than that, because by allowing it to go unchecked during that time, people have been fed continuously. And let's face it, when people get their news off of social media, duh, and they think, oh, it's true because it's on the internet. That's what we have created under, and let's face it, those who were trying to undermine the country, the minds of people who were further advanced than most of our citizenry unfortunately, is that if we can just continue this thing, we can split it. We can destroy it. I think that was ultimately the goal. And they are so close. They are close. Now, I have confidence in youth. And there's a lot of good that has come from the internet and social media. Because even people living in the most remote areas can somehow see people and reflections of themselves and think, if not today, one day, I can get away from here. That's hope that generations ago we didn't have. And the fact, even though it's being threatened from the Supreme Court on down, that one day I can marry the person that I love. Just the person that's so huge in terms of looking forward to life. May not be able to do it here, but one day. That's so powerful. Get on here. Yes, just powerful.
It absolutely is powerful. And in the work that Bree and I do, we've seen a theme that I think relates to what you're touching on, which is the not only the representation and the ability to serve as a positive example to inspire and give hope, but also just the way in which the work of advocates in the LGBTQ community and the illumination of the power and love and positive energy that is put into the world as a result of this community, the way in which we all benefit from it, those of us who are not members of the community, the things that we get that help us live our lives better and see those positive examples for hope in even in our own lives, even if we're not a member of the community, that comes out for us again and again in the people that we talk with. And I think it really refutes the concept that there's some specific group of people who life would be better if they could go back. I don't think that's actually true for anyone, even if there is a group that believes it is the case.
Of course not. I think that there is a false hope and a false security in looking back. But it isn't. Where has it been successful? The world has continued to move forward. It leaves behind those who were so entrenched in the past that they couldn't move forward.
Ron, I think the hopeful message you share with us that we are moving forward, that times are better today than ever before, but it also is, it's incumbent upon us to help keep making it that way, to stand up and speak out like you did over and over again. And that, I think, is the magic in so many leaders from the LGBTQ community, from the African-American community, and so many others that have seen the painful, hurtful things that you have. So to turn that into this message of hope, this message that we can get better, not go backwards, is something that all of us are thankful for in leaders like you. And we're thankful that you decided to take the time to be on our show with us.
I am honored. We have a lot of education to do within our own community, And believe me, along the way, some of my most difficult challenges were with the LGBT community. You know, and I think I need to say it. A lot of it was racism. And the fact that I had been married, there was a whole, like the B didn't exist. It was just the G. And if it weren't the G, you know, but that's another thing. We need to be, continue to be educated. There's a difference between tolerating people around and understanding the people that are around and identifying with the people who are around. Not just the fact that, oh, well, yeah, you can come in. Sure, come in. Have a drink. You know, stand around. But not understanding all the elements of the community. I think that's really the key to our future. And let's face it. What other group of people touches every race, every ethnicity, every socioeconomic strata on the planet than us? To teach the world about love.
We will leave it there. We thank you for teaching us about leaving the world with love, and we hope to continue to explore love and leadership on this series. So thanks again.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you. I enjoyed this so much. You guys were lovely. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Forged in Fire is hosted by Bree Fram and Liz Cavallaro. Produced and engineered by Frida Castellanos and Christina George. Guest management by Trey Worth and original music by Bridget Benemark. The views and ideas expressed by the hosts and guests of this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the organizations or institutions they represent. To learn more about Forged in Fire, please visit us at forgedinfire.org.